This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida. Wow, it is a beautiful day here in Florida, and I am just sending all my greetings, especially to all my all of the guests of who have been on Joy on Paper, who live in Maine, and I don't know, so many of them do, and they were really snowed under there. But I know they had lots of fun because they're writers. And when you're a writer, you don't mind if you are stuck in a blizzard because you can always write. Okay, well, this is going to be a great day because at the bottom of the hour, I am going to play Bria Burton's Book Buzz, her new sci-fi special. It's going to be really, she is so wonderful. She was born to do these sci-fi book buzzes because she's got a wonderful voice. So we're going to play that at the bottom of the hour. And I'm also going to have Claire Feisler today. And we're going to be talking about this wonderful book she's written called No Boundaries. Well, it's a book about, it's a wonderful book. I tell you, it's all about... It's a Nat Geo book. What can I say? You know, when you have a Nat Geo book, and she talks about 25 women explorers and scientists. So we're going to have that. But right now, I get to turn to somebody who I admire so much and whose book is absolutely so much fun. And it is about music. And I love music, of course. And it's Kenny Werner. And he is, so famous. And the name of the book is Becoming the Instrument, Lessons on Self-Mastery from Music to Life. Hi, Kenny.
Hello.
Wow. You know, this book is so, it's like it's just bursting with so much joy and so much understanding and so many brilliant ideas. I love it.
Well, thank you.
Wow. What, as a homeschool mom, my children were involved in music. I spent thousands of hours taking them to music lessons and thousands of hours sitting there and watching their lessons, loving the music, loving that they loved music and that they loved their instruments. So tell us about this wonderful life that you've led as really a leader in the jazz world and just in loving music.
Well, you know, for every person that really gets the joy of music, a lot of people that go after it get the frustration of music. And what I found myself falling into more and more, in addition to my performing, is my teaching of helping people get their mind out of the way so that they really could enjoy music. And that developed into, it's amazing how many people don't get that. So that developed into lectures and master classes. And then now I have the Effortless Mastery. The first book I wrote was Effortless Mastery. And it was really how to give yourself complete love and support while learning music so that you don't feel bad if you play bad, which then has the effect of making you play better.
Exactly.
You know, one of the oldest human nature things is, when we try to do something harder, we do it worse. So part of this book, Becoming the Instrument, is just showing that instead of focusing on how good you are, and too often musicians, not even just musicians, people who play music, transfer from how good you are as a player to how good you are or valuable you are as a person. And that puts a lot of weight on the music. So removing the blocks so that the body plays the instrument, and the mind trains itself to appreciate whatever that body can play instead of comparing it to other bodies or virtuosos or whatever. And that's really what the book is about. And it does have a lot of laughter in it, too, because I like it to be in the language of where I come from. I'm from Long Island. I don't have a mystical background. But I believe that a lot of this stuff that's considered spiritual is really more common sense for supporting yourself if you want to do anything.
Well, there is so much common sense in this book because you know you cover so many subjects. It's, as I said, it's bursting. It's just it's absolutely tremendous. I didn't know, you know, when I was reading it, I was thinking, wow, just to be around you must be so fantastic. And that's why I know that the way that you're teaching people is wonderful. And I'm really sad that more young people are not taking lessons anymore. It's just, you know, been cut off in so many schools and in homes, of course, even during the pandemic here. And yet the ones who have music, the ones who can play an instrument, if you have a piano in your house and you can sit down there, you know, and you're stuck in a pandemic, but you still have your instrument and you can make music. And it's so wonderful. It's a wonderful feeling.
Well, it's the right state of mind. You know, what you say is what people presume all musicians feel. In fact, a majority of them don't. They feel blocked and they feel frustrated. So, yes, ideally, music is there for us, to support us, and to experience an expanded place, even when our external options are limited, like, you know, in a quarantine. But if you judge yourself as a player, that's yet another chair you can't sit in that house. It makes the house smaller, you know? So the right state of mind allows music to support people and delight people who play it in the way it was meant to. And the wrong state of mind makes it just another game board where they judge themselves.
Well, explain your background. How did you become a musician? What was your childhood like?
Well, that's what's even weird. I was very talented. I started at 7, and then at 11, I had done a record, and it looked like I was going this route of child prodigy, but like sort of television child prodigy. I was on TV shows, and then it all just went left, and I found myself doing very ordinary stuff. So bar mitzvahs and weddings, which for a musician is just kind of, you know, workmanlike. And then I kind of went into a dark place for music. But I had a few teachers that taught me that the spirit and the state of mind transcended the music itself. In other words, you could play badly with a generous state of mind and have a ball. You could play well with a judgmental state of mind and have anxiety about your playing. So, you know, in the mind is the liberation to really enjoy music as a player, and anybody can. See, there's a common thing that the mind tells us. Oh, well, only certain people can be musicians, and either some of us have it and some of us don't. And my book posits the idea that everybody has it. Some of us know it, and some of us don't. But if you're willing to drop your demands and your judgment, you have it. One note can vibrate in your body, and then you add another note. And there's just nobody that's excluded from the kingdom of heaven of music.
Well, part of the problem, you know, if you want to be a professional musician, it is very difficult from the point of view that they have now develop this system where it has to be exact. It has to be perfect. And this is very frustrating. I know. It's very frustrating. I will tell you, my son was playing Chopin. And, you know, when you are in competition, in a Chopin competition, the timing, almost every single one who plays at the exact same length of time. I mean, it's perfect.
Right.
It's absolutely perfect. I mean, if it's going to be a song that's going to take 5 minutes and 32 seconds, almost every single one of them play it 5 minutes and 32 seconds. My son wouldn't do that. He played it the way he felt it in his heart. And I would always get comments from people who would say, well, I think that's how Chopin would play it. It might not have been perfect, but he loved it.
But you see, the point is, anybody may give themselves the same license that Chopin gave himself. You don't have to be deemed a genius by somebody else to enjoy this landscape. And very often it leads to success. success in it from a different route. The funny thing is, I didn't get a lot of the main frontline successes. I kept honoring myself in a different way, and then I had the language to talk about. That's what's unusual. Usually there is liberation language about music, but it's the best language is from people that don't really play very well. And then there's people that really play great, and you see what emanates from them, but they can't talk about it. So I've always been like a two-language person. I speak music, and I also speak the explanation of why the music rises above the intellect to go to the superconscious.
So talk about your idea here of space, the space. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, you know, there are many names for it. Every religion has a name for it, whether it's the Holy Spirit or Hashem or a superconscious mind in more psychology circles or universal mind and philosophical circles and in spiritual paths, the Shakti. You know, everything has word. I just made, to me, a Long Island name for the space. It's a space. It's a space between thoughts. It's a space between the past and the future. When you're in this moment, you're not thinking. In this time that we live in, if you're able to be in this moment without thinking, I would say that's the dominant religion of our time. Just to feel in the absence of the future and the past, you find out there's so much self-support rising from within. But it's the ability to get into the space, and we use our breath to get into the space. And even if we were there for 30 seconds or 20 seconds or a minute, we find out who we are without all these clouds that obscure the true light of our own self. Everybody's got the same light. Chopin did not burn any brighter than anyone else, but for some reason, his awareness was closer to the fire. Many of us are very far, have many clouds between us and that same fire because of intellectual assumptions. I'm not that talented, or I don't deserve this, or, you know, this is going to take a lot of time. All these things happen in the world of thought. In the space, you're not thinking. From the space, you touch the instrument, and you realize success has already been achieved. The point is to become one with the sound of the instrument. And then whatever you play is going to have not just weight within your own heart, but it will resonate in the hearts of others who are listening to you.
Well, you know, there, as I said, there's so many different chapters, and I love all of your talking points or your ideas, your suggestions. I want to talk a little bit about the chapter 2 because I loved it when you wrote, "It started with the wind." And I think the wind is so magical, and it's such a shame more people just don't take time to just listen to the wind. I grew up in northern Michigan, and I spent half of my summers in a hammock tied between two birch trees. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and on YouTube, they have the sound of birch trees, and I play it every couple of days because it calms you down. And it does get you in touch with something very deep inside us.
Right. That's what I call the space. By calling it the space, I give the attributes of the space to demonstrate how available it is. Most people think this is a mystical thing hiding behind the physical world, and you have to go to the Himalayas or you have to do ritual. I found it's uncommonly easy to go there. If you just watch yourself breathe, even for 20 seconds, and you really just watch it breathe. You don't attach any spiritual meaning to it, but just watch it breathe. At that moment, you'll be in the moment, in the space, and from there, you play your first note. And that first note resonates through you first and then to everybody else. But see, the book is about music, lessons and self-mastery from music to life. So the reason the subjects are so vast is because it starts with my understanding of what freedom feels like in music, self-love, and discipline. I mean, discipline has a role, but it can be destroyed by ego, just like playing can be destroyed by ego, trying to do too much, feeling overwhelmed. And this is a big problem in our entire university system. people are overwhelmed and they don't think they should even complain about it. They think they're supposed to be overwhelmed. The problem is, with being overwhelmed, you're not really absorbing anything. Then when you play, you wish you would play that, but of course you didn't absorb it, so it doesn't happen. So there's a whole dysfunction that is definitely promoted by the university system, and I speak as one that teaches in the university system, but I am paid to try to have this renegade effect on more and more people in our school. And Berkeley, where I teach, I have the Effortless Mastery Institute, but the school itself was 7,000 students, by far the largest music school in the world. And yet they want this idea of don't be overwhelmed by all the subjects. Try to find, you know, don't just be threshed about in the hurricane. Try to find the eye of the hurricane. And the eye of the hurricane, find out what you need next to support your music. And you need a teacher that's of the same mind. So really my work, which helps the students that are in my class, but the other part of my work is to continue to suggest things to the teachers. And it really does resonate in their hearts, because many of the teachers are people who have unrealized dreams in their playing. And the reason is that they followed the same abusive course as their students. So they pass it on. It's abusive to just be introduced to a subject, have it come, you don't have time to own it, then it goes, and you start to think, well, I guess I'm not very talented. So where it's not even your fault. The fact is, it takes as long as it takes to own a piece of music. And once you own it, you feel like one of those, as we say in jazz, you feel like one of the cats. They're playing, and God, I'm playing. But if you don't know the material, you just know it just well enough to drown or keep your nose above water, no wonder kids quit. Who needs more homework? You know, when you start school, the first thing that should be shown to them is what a kick it is for their imagination. Instead, the first thing they learn is how to read, which is arguably the least important thing. But then they carry a misimpression about music for the rest of their lives. I wish I could have been one, because there's special properties you need, and I don't have those properties. But anyone can develop it if they're patient and self-supportive and connect. But of course, to connect, they have to believe that they're supposed to connect. There's nobody that's not supposed to connect with music. If there is a God, that's his gift to us. You start to play notes, and you're connected if you have the right understanding.
Oh, I love to think of you sitting right there at the piano. It's just, it's wonderful.
I always do it for the piano, yeah. Because I could play this, and I'm still feeling enriched by the sound. I don't have the normal self-judgment faculties anymore. It can be neurologically reprogrammed so that when you touch an instrument, you imbibe the sound of it. And you know what? I believe it's an undiscovered therapy for all kinds of liberating things for the mind, for musicians and non-musicians alike. So I'm just kind of following what's coming out. And I did a book 26 years ago, which was kind of a data dump of what I had found. And I felt now, later, I felt it's time to dump it again, but related to the whole world. There are lessons that musicians very clearly have. Music makes it very clear what the lessons are. But a lot of those lessons are transferable, whether you're a middle-level manager or a CEO or a computer programmer. And that's the point of the book, that people can live an artistic life no matter with the right understanding, no matter what their fate is.
And having music in your life enriches you. It makes you, you walk around, I think, with a different feeling in your heart. And I hope that more people will, I think more people are starting to understand they have to start putting down these electronic gizmos all the time, that they have these fingers that can play a piano, or you can play a trumpet, or you can find whatever instrument grabs your heart. I know a woman who, she was starting to get arthritis in her fingers, and she wanted to do something before she lost it, and she started playing cello, and then the next thing she knew, and she just started really, you know, very simply, but she, her, you know, her fingers got better, and she was so happy.
Right.
She just feels so energized by just, in the mornings, she sits with her cello now, hugging it against her heart, and playing with all her heart. She's not perfect. She started with, you know,
that's
like
the least important thing.
Yeah, exactly. She started with Twinkle Twinkle Little Stars, and she's working her, but she's loving every single minute of it.
But you see, the relationship is this. We know that the right spirit can actually be a factor in healing something that doctors, you know, would not be able to heal. But how do we get the spirit? We have to eliminate intellectual blocks. So the process is, how do you empty your mind? And I'm giving a lot of suggestions that are kind of humorous, too. So I don't want people to take it too seriously. I want them to know that the higher part of themselves is sitting right next to the noisy part of themselves. Now, they just kind of go like a, that they can inhale out of one room and exhale into another room, and that room is nothing but space and possibilities. So I do it in a light way. I like people to laugh about because I don't want anybody to think you have to be innately spiritual to find it. But in fact, what happened to her is her pain is the great motivator. We all say that, right? So pain gave her a different attitude as to why she was playing cello. She wasn't thinking, well, I have debilitating arthritis, but I'll become a professional cellist. She said, I have a debilitating arthritis. Let me empty my pain into this cello. So she had a silver lining. You know what I mean? What could have been thought of as a great setback was a silver lining because she didn't come at music with an ego. Most people, it's hard to play too long before you start asking this question, am I a good player? And as you start to ask that question, the fun or the light starts to dim.
Exactly. And, you know, she plays, you know, for you know, her friends and her grandchildren, and they don't care if she misses a note. They don't know. They love it. They're enthralled with it. And this is what people can learn, that, you know, you can be walking, you know, you can be in a pub, and somebody, you know, plays an instrument and picks up a violin and plays. It's not perfect, but wow, it lifts your heart. It fills you with joy. And
I was just going to say, there's a class of musicians that is so perfect and so virtuoso that we're supposed to enjoy them, but it's a mistake to compare ourselves unfavorably to them. Music works at all levels to do its bidding, which is the delight or, in many cases, the healing of a person. I'm hoping what they get my book, they might put the book down and start playing their instrument again. But more so, I hope they put the book down, go to their job, and feel that same space, which gives them a new appreciation for something that they were bored with before because they were looking at it from the wrong state of mind.
Well, it is a wonderful book, and it is called Becoming the Instrument, Lessons on Self-Mastery from Music to Life by Kenny Werner. And I will tell everybody, it's laid out in such a fascinating way. There are different chapters. There are ideas on, you know, things that you can do. I love chapter 24, The Genius Inside. You know, this is so important that people just find themselves in a different place. Get away from some of this, you know, really some of the electronics and the televisions and all of this that bog you down and repeat, watching repeats of television shows because you don't know what to do. But if you embrace music and just go for it, what the heck, have fun. Oh, I love
it. You made a point that I have never thought of before, because among the electronic things you talked about, you mentioned texting. Because people don't have an ego about how they text, you see some people texting, they're like demons. There's nobody that could text like that that couldn't play a piano.
Exactly. I've seen it. And
and I never thought of that before, but it's true.
It's true. Absolutely. And really, everybody, you should get this book, Becoming the Instrument, Lessons on Self-Mastery. And Kenny, you have a website?
Yes, yeah, just kennywerner.com. And that's where you can. There's also written audio meditations with me playing piano behind it, and you should try that out, actually.
You know, I I don't have much more time. I can't. I wanted really to talk to you about jazz because I've been into jazz since I was very young, and I wanted to go through a lot of. So, will you come back?
I will.
Okay, I'm going to arrange a time.
Talk jazz with you.
Yeah, and we'll talk jazz because I love jazz, and I'll tell you all about my background in jazz too. So, you're going to come back, but before we leave, do you want to play a riff, a jazz riff for us to leave us with?
You want a jazz riff, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. I had walked away from the piano, but only about 8 feet.
You're never
far. Get too much further.
You're never far. And I just want to thank you. Oh, that makes my day. Kenny, I'm going to be smiling all day just because I heard that riff. That's fantastic. You're going to come back on, and we're going to have you set up near the piano, and we're going to talk just jazz. How about that?
Beautiful. Sounds great. I look forward to it.
Okay. Thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper. You are a joy. Sure. Kenny Werner.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that's great. We're going to have Bria Burton, Book Buzz.
Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes a 2021 release in print and ebook, Vigil, Inferno Season, Book 2 in the Cybernight Saga by Bard Constantine. Readers who start with Vigil, Book 1, will discover how the Cataclysm caused the end of the world as Hellraiser soldier Jet Wolf knew it, and follow his transformation into high-tech hero Vigil. Now that you've had your briefing, let's download the book buzz. In a sinister dystopian future that blends the noir, superhero, and cyberpunk genres, a man out of time fights behind a mask in the crime-ridden streets of New York, where corrupt and brutal villains, robots with electro-lasers, and synthoid clones roam. 300 years after Jet Wolf fell into cryosleep, he awakens and stumbles into a society split in two. Havencore is a closed-off dome for the elites, and all others scrape a living on the outside, where crime lords and gangs rule largely unchecked. When we pick up in Book 2, Vigil pairs up with Spitfire, a street-smart teenager who joins his growing team to battle Diabolus, a trifecta of crime syndicates dealing in stolen memories, the latest drug craze at the Hayes Parlors. The trail leads Vigil and his team deep into the underbelly, an abyss beneath the city where nothing is as it seems. This masterful neo-pulp mashup with jaw-dropping twists would be one binge-worthy television series if the right producer picks it up. My casting choice for Vigil would be between Henry Simmons, aka Mac from Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., or Mike Coulter, who played Luke Cage in the Netflix series and currently stars in CBS's Evil. Bard Constantine is a pen name for Alabama author Lewis Knight, a self-described neo-pulp author who writes genre-blended, action-oriented pulp fiction with a kick. People come for the action and stay for the appealing characters. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I am. What I'm is my guest on? Okay, well, I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper somebody from Nat Geo. You know, I love Nat Geo books. They are, when I get a Nat Geo book, I get so excited. Claire Fiesler, did I pronounce it right?
Fiesler.
Okay, well, you know, I'm sorry about that. Fiesler.
No, it's okay. A German last name, just too many vowels. You know?
That gets you. Well, Claire Fiesler, and the name of the book is No Boundaries. 25 women explorers and scientists share adventures, inspiration, and advice. And, of course, it is a Nat Geo book. And I always think that the happiest and most lucky people in the world are those who work with Nat Geo, because you have so much fun.
It's true, yeah. I've been affiliated with National Geographic since 2000, and I've been working for them since 2006. And so it's been a real joy, almost 16 years. Wow.
Well, I like that you use the word joy. How appropriate. Because, well, that's how I feel about Nat Geo. They are wonderful. And as I've often said, if I had more kids, I, instead of saying, grow up to be a doctor, grow up to be a lawyer, I'd say, grow up to work with National Geographic, because you'll have so much more fun.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm a National Geographic explorer. That means that in my work in doing documentary work as a journalist and as a scientist, they fund a lot of my projects. And a lot of parents and young girls will ask me, how do I become a National Geographic explorer? And I'm always kind of caught on my heels saying, like, there's no one formula. It's not like, you know, being a lawyer. You go to law school, you get a law degree, and boom, you're a lawyer. Each of the women in our book have a really unique path to not just becoming an explorer, but also just making a difference in science and exploration. And we wanted to show to girls that there's no one way to do it. There's no one way to look as an explorer, but also that the road there can be challenging and full of obstacles and failures, and to normalize that and to make it approachable, that the journey can be hard, though rewarding.
Well, of course, you are a doctor, so I should say Dr. Fiesler. But
yes.
But, you know, for kids to just to know that women can do anything, and we've known that forever, and this celebration of these 25 women, you know, I don't know where to start, but since I'm broadcasting from Florida, I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about Jenny Adler and about the Florida Freshwater Springs.
Yeah, we have two fantastic explorers who are based out of Florida who have done incredible work on this Florida environment, and I'll tell you about them. But the funny thing is we started writing this book 3.5 years ago, and we picked our explorers 3 years ago. And during that time between when we started, you know, interviewing them and writing this book, those two explorers actually started working together. And so they're actually, the two of them, Mallory and Jenny, are actually working together on a project to document and preserve the Florida Wildlife Corridor, which is a plan to kind of connect all the green wild spaces in Florida before they become encroached on by, you know, the rapid development that you see there. But just to start off with Jenny Adler, what I love about Jenny Adler's story is that she shows that, you know, you don't have to go the traditional route to become a scientist. So Jenny was a young nature-loving woman who wanted to get her PhD in ecology, and she first started out with studying snails. And she was going to do, you know, a PhD on this really particular type of snail. But on the weekends, she started becoming really interested in diving, and specifically cave diving in the really unique freshwater aquifers that are all around Florida. And these aquifers are kind of like, you know, Florida's made up of limestone. It's kind of like stone that is more like Swiss cheese than anything else. And the water from the underground water table kind of comes up, and these underground aquifers form these caves, and they have unique animals in them. And often you'll see manatees coming into these freshwater aquifers, and it's just so rich with biodiversity. And she would spend time exploring them and scuba diving in them. And she decided that she, you know, this was her passion. She didn't want to study snails. She wanted people to fall in love with these underground caves and aquifers and freshwater systems. And so she shifted halfway through her PhD from studying snails to studying the way that photography and storytelling can influence people's perspectives and attitudes towards these incredible environments in Florida. And that's what she did. That's what she got her PhD in, essentially kind of science communication.
And it's important because we've been having a lot of problems right here in our area of losing manatees. It breaks my heart every time I hear. We just had a story this morning on our news.
It's really, really sad, and that's why these freshwater areas become really important refuges for the manatees when they're trying to escape the cold, but also when they're trying to escape boat traffic, because these freshwater areas, these freshwater springs and caves, they don't have boats in them. So they become little kind of safe places for manatees. And Jenny has an incredible job documenting that as an underwater photographer.
Well, there are so many stories. So we have 25 fantastic women. I want to talk about one that, I love elephants. And one of my favorite books, I don't know if you've ever read it. It's by Peter Riva. It's called Tribal Rumble.
No, I've never read that.
Well, it is a book. The Audible book is so beautiful, and it is about African elephants. And because of Peter Riva, who was on my program, it's a book for all of you lovers of nature. The tribal it's called A Tribal Rumble, a Safari Campfire Tale, and it tells the story of elephants in Africa. And and so when I was reading the one about the national park in Zimbabwe, it's the Wange, we pronounce it Wange
National Park,
and about Dr. Moran, how do you pronounce her name? Morangels?
Morangels and Biza.
And Biza. Wow.
Dr. Morangels and Biza.
Tell us about this. This is amazing. Now, have you had a chance to actually go out there yourself?
Yeah. So in the beginning of the book, the introduction is my co-author, Gabby Salzar, and I wrote. And in the introduction, there's a picture of us standing in the African savannah with Dr. Morangels and Biza. And National Geographic had funded us to go out there and document her unique work, which we made into a short documentary that National Geographic, you can watch on National Geographic's YouTube channel. If you just Google One Woman's Incredible Story with Lions, I think it will show up. Or you can Google my name in National Geographic on YouTube. And we made the short documentary, and it was really that short documentary which I'll explain just in a second, but then some editors from National Geographic Kids Book approached us and said, we would love to take Morangel's story and other stories, incredible stories of women, overcoming obstacles, gender-based obstacles, and make it into a kids book. And so when we went to Zimbabwe, we had no idea we would eventually include her in this book or that a book would be made. It was somewhat serendipitous. We went out there to document her work in a short documentary because her work is, and maybe I'll just ask listeners and yourself, Patsy, but do you remember that famous lion that was shot by that American dentist? It was Cecil the Lion.
Oh.
This story made headlines.
Yes. Oh, it just made me crazy.
Yeah, it was this lion that had a collar, a radio collar on it, which means it was being studied by a group from Oxford University. And these radio collars, you know, they had years of rich information about this lion. But the lion was also just really majestic and beautiful. And he was in Hwange National Park, which is, you know, Zimbabwe's kind of crown jewel of their national parks, very close to Victoria Falls. And he was so popular with the tourists that tourists would come just to see this lion. He was just so majestic. And he had such a large pride, and he was really beloved. He was called the, you know, Africa's most famous lion. And then a trophy hunter working with a team had lured this animal outside of the protective barriers of the park and shot the lion as part of a trophy hunt, which is illegal. You can't shoot a lion that is collared, that has a radio collar on it, and you can't lure a lion outside of a national park. So it was very controversial at the time, and awareness of this controversy was raised by, you know, even late night talk show hosts. I don't even remember, but Jimmy Kimmel was really outraged about it, and he urged his viewers to kind of write letters, and they raised money for the group that was studying this lion. They're called Wild Crew out of Oxford, and that money was used to fund the final years of Marangels and Bees' PhD work working on this lion. And Marangels was the scientist who had actually put the radio collar on Cecil before he died. And she was studying him and other lions in the area. And what's so incredible about her work is that these lions are just, they interact with people because there's a lot of cattle herders near the park. And it's a real problem. And so Marangels' work is trying to better understand how the lions move through the park and move off, you know, outside the boundaries to try to decrease and create solution, decrease conflict and create solutions so that these people living near the park, these Zimbabweans and the lions, can live peaceably together. And the reason why her story, you know, not only is her work incredible, but she's a mother. She's a single mom, and she had put her son in this great school in South Africa. She's working in Zimbabwe, and she's getting her PhD in England in Oxford. And she was traveling between these three countries for years. And it was just taking such a toll on her. And she told me about this bus ride, a 36-hour bus ride she would take from seeing her son in South Africa through, you know, really dangerous areas, going to her field site in Hwange National Park where the lions were. And I went on the bus ride with her, and it was shocking, you know, what she kind of had to go through on a weekly basis to be a mom, do incredible lions conservation work, and get a PhD at, you know, the world's most renowned university. And she cried in front of us talking about the struggles and how hard it was, and we included that in the book. And you know, she said that, you know, as long as I can make a difference, it is worth it. And I think her perseverance and the perseverance of the other women in this book is just something that we really wanted to highlight and show to young girls that they can do similar ambitious things, but to expect perseverance to be part of it.
Well, I think it's one of the wonderful things about this book, and for girls to understand that, you know, it is not easy for so many people in other countries where getting an education is not easy. And we have here the opportunity really to study as much as we want. I love that there's the STEM programs. When I was young, I've always been into science. I was a math and science person. So that always, from the time I was little, intrigued me, and I was always interested in it. And I'm so happy that, you know, Nat Geo has done such a service over the years in getting girls to understand that you can be anything you want to be. And we have it lucky in this country that we have all these opportunities for study that really other people have to, as you said, travel 36 hours in a bus. You've done a wonderful job here in bringing out this wide array of women from all over the world.
Well, yeah, thank you. It's just, it's, and I think that the point there that you said women from all over the world is really important, because, you know, I think that our audience will be mostly American audience. The book is also widely distributed in the UK. But if you look, the third to last page in the book is a map. And we specifically worked with the map department at National Geographic to create this map. And we wanted to have pinpoints across this map that represented where these women live and work. And we have the whole globe covered. And by kind of making sure we told stories of women working across the world and living in different places of the world, by association we captured, you know, the diversity of the scientists themselves and the backgrounds that they come from. And so we have women from rural areas of Chad, we have women from the Philippines, we have women from Sri Lanka, we have women, from South America, we have Americans, but Americans that found themselves, all over the world as well.
And there are so many places this is what Nat Geo did for me. I became a world traveler because of the yellow magazines that came to us, mm-hmm. and that's set me in a different world. From all of my neighbors, all of my other friends in school, none of them got a Nat Geo magazine in their home. Mm-hmm. And we didn't actually share them. We didn't let anyone touch them. I'm sorry to say, and I look back on it, but I was rather selfish. But that's why I became a world traveler myself. And so when I was reading about, somebody like Mallory Dimmitt, this just mapping North America wildlife corridors, I think that's so wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, I think what's interesting about, your childhood memories of National Geographic magazine, I think so many people have those memories because for so long, up until I guess even the 90s, that for so many people and kids, that was really their only kind of window to the wider world. Of course, now we have cell phones and National Geographic is not the only one making documentaries, and we've got the Discovery Channel and this and that. And I think what National Geographic continues to do to reinvent themselves is to, continue to be a portal to this wider world and to encourage people to travel and travel sustainably, but to tell more nuanced stories about the wider world. Because for so long, the National Geographic magazine predominantly featured men, white men, exploring the world.
And now it is everybody, and it is fantastic. I don't have much more time, but I have to ask you this. I want to tell my listeners that one of the things that you're famous for, Dr. Fiesler, is that you actually rappel down a rock cliff with a broken foot to photograph something. Tell everybody, what did you want to photograph?
My very first assignment working for National Geographic as a photographer, I pitched them the idea of going to Ascension Island, which is one of the most remote islands in the world in the Atlantic, because the world's rarest fern is there. And it was thought to be extinct 100 years ago, and it was noted by Charles Darwin. And they rediscovered it a couple of years ago, just clinging to life on the side of this cliff. And I wanted to document the efforts, some incredible, optimism of animals coming back from the brink. And I went there, but I had a broken foot, and I said, that's not going to stop me. And so I went there in a boot, and I went and I had to rappel down this cliff with a rope in order to photograph this fern that is no bigger than the size of my thumb. And for me, that was just, that is like one of my greatest joys. And it was a true National Geographic moment.
So what is the name of the fern? Do you remember the name?
It's called the Ascension Island Parsley Fern. Yeah, and since they rediscovered those individuds, they have since, the Kew Gardens in London, they have since propagated hundreds and hundreds of more and have like a revival program for that fern specifically. And people think, like, why revive, this rare fern that only exists on this one mountain, on this one island? And, my response is, we don't know what secrets nature holds.
Exactly.
And what secrets this fern holds until we study it more. So.
Okay, well, people can find out more about you. You have a website, your own website, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's www.c... C F I E S CCELER.com, CCSLER.com. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram, find more about me, and you find a link to our book.
And, of course, Nat Geo, everybody should just go to Nat Geo all the time. I didn't get to talk about Gabby Salazar because she did a lot of stuff in here.
Yeah, she was my co-author, and this book would not have been happened without her, because she really pushed me to do this book when I was approached to do it by editors at National Geographic. She said, you know, this audience, middle school audience, these are the people we want to reach.
Well, I would actually like maybe she could come on too, and we can talk about it, because for me, I became very deeply, you know, involved in this whole thing of elephants. Elephant numbers have dropped 62% over the past decade. This is just breaks my heart every time I hear about them killing elephants, or somebody crazy shooting a beautiful lion for no reason. So I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. Everybody, this book, it's beautiful. Of course, it's a Nat Geo book, so you know it's beautiful. The best production values in the world.
It's perfect for children between the ages of 8 and 14.
Oh, it's perfect for everyone between the ages of 8 and 80. I am having so much fun reading it. You know, I go back and forth every once in a while. You know, I read it once, but you go back and you look at it again, and the photographs, well, they just blow your mind. They're fantastic. And it's called No Boundaries, 25 Women Explorers and Scientists Share Adventures, Inspiration, and Advice. And it's a Nat Geo book, so we know it's wonderful. Thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you so much for having me, Pat.
Okay. Claire Fiesler. Thank you. Dr. Claire Fiesler. Bye-bye now.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Okay. Well, that went fast. This is a beautiful book. Oh, it's incredible. You know, Valentine's Day is coming up, and I am telling you, you have to make, just like I make Thanksgiving Day, is for me a Nat Geo gift day. Well, I think Valentine's Day is another Nat Geo gift day. You have to give a gift of a book, because you give a card. It's nice to have a card, but boy, oh boy, if you give a book like this to a kid, especially to a girl, but I think this is also a book boys will enjoy. The photographs are wonderful. And you give this, and the girl is going to have it for the rest of her life, because one thing you know about Nat Geo books, I've never seen a Nat Geo book in a garage sale. People don't give them away. When I was a kid, we didn't share our magazines because we didn't trust other people to be as careful as we were. So get a Nat Geo book for somebody this Valentine's Day. My goodness, can you believe it's already February 2022? And make it a Nat Geo Valentine's Day for everybody. And I have to say goodbye because I'm running out of time. But remember what I always tell everyone. One of the joys of life is to write and to read. And I don't have time. And I have to say bye-bye because Big Ed is playing me out of here. Are you going to salute me, Big Ed? And drive you crazy today. And he's saluting me. And thank you, Larson and Larson. And thank you, Glenn Erickson, for supporting Joy on Paper. I love you all. Say something nice to somebody today. Have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And don't go shooting lions, but get this wonderful book from Nat Geo and also from Kenny Werner. And get some music in your heart. That's what we all need. Music in our hearts with Kenny Werner. And he's going to come back on Joy on Paper because I love music. Bye-bye now.